Let's now enjoy the words of this beautiful prophet. So we're chapter 1, verse 2, the beginning of the prophecy. When Yahweh first spoke through Hosea, Yahweh said to Hosea, "Go, take for yourself a wife of whoredom," a whore in other words, "and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking Yahweh." So what have we got here? It's not that clear, but I'll give you as best I can. What it helps us see as an insight into the prophets, all of them, is that Hosea is going to speak out of his own personal experience. What else can you do? Unless you're going to read a book or abstract theology, which is, does no good to anybody. So his experience, it appears that he did take as his wife, as a fact, he married a woman who was called there a wife of whoredom. Now there's two possibilities here, because the Bible is frequently speaks about whoredom metaphorically, as like worshipping a wrong god, and God is the husband, you know, and the community is the wife, and we're being unfaithful, but unfaithful not sexually, but religiously. So that's a very common thing through the Bible, which you probably know already, and you'll see plenty of it. So it may be that she's called a wife of whoredom because she belongs to a group that are not worshipping Yahweh, but worshipping another god, Ashtarte or Asherah or Baal, or, you got it? Could be that. Or it could be, because another practice at the time was, she might have been involved in sexual rites, which were pretty common in that part of the world. So what have you got? You've got, it's a pagan thing. I think it's pretty common, I have to tell you. I don't know about it in today's world, but maybe it is too. I wouldn't know. But what it is they would go to a ceremony, a ritual, and they'd have virgins there who'd never had sex with anybody. And the priests and the other people with advantage would be there having sex with these virgins, all with a view to helping the crop. Can you see the... No, well, not just their own crop, but because there was like sympathetic magic. If a man and a woman have sexual relationships and it's fruitful, well then the gods and the goddesses of the fields and the harvest, you can follow all this, can't you? Then this will bring about, as a religious ceremony, a ritual, it will bring about the favour of the gods. So this is all over the world in those days. And the gods would then make sure there was a good harvest. So it could have been that she was a woman, because a lot of them were caught up in it, whether they liked it or not. She may have been caught up in that, and he had an eye for her and decided he wanted to make this a more permanent arrangement. So he ends up marrying this woman. You enjoying this? Anyone under 21 should go now. All right. So, the prophecy goes on. So, out of his own experience, we've got to watch for what he's learning about God from it. So, he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And Yahweh said to him, "Name him Jezreel." Jezreel was the city on the southern part of that transverse valley I just spoke about, sometimes called the valley, or the eastern part, the valley of Jezreel, or in general the valley of Esdraelon. So, "Name him Jezreel, for in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. And I'll put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I shall break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." A fact that you need to know, and you wouldn't be expected to know, is that Jeroboam II, who is the king at the beginning of Hosea's ministry, was the last, well, his son was the next one, but he was assassinated immediately. So he was the last in the dynastic line, the last of the Windsors. But he was the last of the Jehu line. And Jehu exterminated the line before him. And by the way, he was told to do it by one of the prophets. It's an interesting history. Elisha told him to do it, and God told him to tell him to do it, or he thought he did. And that was done, and he was killed in the Valley of Jezreel. So this is considered. So what's happened is, probably, the death of Jeroboam II, the murder of his son, the end of the dynasty, is seen by Hosea as God's punishment. You following the logic of it? God's punishment for what Jehu did to the house of Omri in the 900s, or late 800s. However, everything's going nicely in the little household of Hosea, because she conceived again. And she bore a daughter this time. Dear little darling thing she was. And Yahweh said to him, name her Lo Ruhama. And all you Hebrew scholars will find this obvious. Ruhama means pity. Lo in Hebrew is the negative. Not pity. Call her not pity, for I no longer have pity on the house of Israel. I will withdraw it from them. Withdraw the kingdom from them. But I will have pity on the house of Judah. Who wrote that in? Was that a later thing put in by an editorial hand? Almost inevitably. Because, you know, God's on their side. And I'll save them by Yahweh their God. And I'm suggesting that's a little gloss that's put in a bit later. May not be, but it probably is. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or horsemen. When she'd weaned Lo Ruhama, she conceived and bore a son. Then Yahweh said, name him Lo Ami. Am in Hebrew means people. I is my. So Lo Ami means not my people. So that's the name given to the kid. For you are not my people, and I am not your I am. Which is another way of talking about Yahweh. And some scholars suggest, I don't know, but it sounds likely, that you are not my people and I am not your God is actually the form, possibly, of the divorce at that time. I'm not your, you're not my wife, I'm not your husband, that's the end of it. That's only men could divorce women, obviously. The other women didn't have a say. And once the man said that, that was it. And remember the argument even to the time of Jesus. That was still the case, only a man could divorce. But could he do it for any reason, or could he only do it because of some sexual misbehaviour or whatever? Was the debate going on at the time of Jesus? And they brought it up to him, and we won't talk about that now. But here we've got the God is saying, I'm divorcing you from being my people. The text continues. Yes. The number of my people of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which can be neither measured nor numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel shall be gathered together. They shall appoint for themselves one head, and they shall take possession of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brother, Ami, brackets, not Lo Ami, but Ami, my people. And say to your sister, Ruhama, brackets, not Lo Ruhama, but Ruhama. What have you got here? You've got typical of the prophets. They're talking, he's seeing what's happening in the world, politically and militarily. He sees it as a punishment of God. He's looking at why it is, because they're not worshipping God properly. They're worshipping the fields and the, whatever, the economy of the day or whatever it is they're worshipping. All that's going on. But he does transcend that. But it's actually a statement of hope. It's a statement of... it's a statement about God, really. It's not a statement about history. He's saying, okay, we've been unfaithful, you're being unfaithful, but God will never be unfaithful. God is the God of pity, the God of mercy, the God who is faithful to his people. So it sounds like it's contradicting the first statement. The first statement is about people and what they're doing wrong, etc. The second statement is about God and God's fidelity to do what is right. But it's a hope statement. It's not a crystal ball thing. It's a statement of faith, because he believes and knows in faith, which is the same as believes, that God will transcend our sin and our stupidity and our infidelity, and God will always be faithful. So you will still be God's people, and you will one day still be the one on whom he shows pity. The text continues. Accuse your mother. Accuse, for she is not my wife. I am not her husband. That she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. Or I will strip her naked and expose her as on the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and turn her into a parched land, and kill her with thirst. What kind of an image of God have you got here? It's a bit jumpy, but that's the text. You've got to take it as it is. But again, you can see the metaphorical stuff going on here about infidelity and so on. Upon her children also I will have no pity, because they are children of whoredom. Hosea saw, well, this is how he interpreted the history of his day. The history of his day has got a lot to do with the power of Assyria and the Assyrian army, surely. But he's looking at it from a religious point of view as a sign, because God must be behind. Are you following me in this? God must be behind the victory of Assyria. And if God's behind it, God must be punishing us. Logic, God is just. So we've got to look at what we're doing wrong to change the situation. For their mother played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I'll go after my lovers, Baal, Asherah, etc. And they give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. I don't know, what would our equivalent be, the stock exchange? I don't know. I mean, you'd have to think it through what it would be. You know, who do we worship as a culture, as a people? Where do we go? Who do we rely on for our bread and water and wool and flax and oil and drink? Are we willing to compromise our faith to get that? I don't know. It's all a terrifically big topic. And here, she did not know. She means Israel. She didn't know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine and the oil. It was I, this is Yahweh, as seen by Hosea, it was I who lavished upon her silver and gold that they used for Baal. Therefore I will take back my grain in its time and my wine in its season, and I'll take away my wool and my flax which were to cover her nakedness. Now I will uncover her shame in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand. One of the punishments for adultery, in getting to the sexual side, was that the woman would be stripped bare and hair would be cut off, and there's a whole lot of things. Don't ask me what happened to the bloke. Probably nothing. But anyhow, so that was the system they were working under. So here we're using it metaphorically. They're being stripped bare of they're losing Jezreel, they're losing their fields, they're losing their independence, etc. I will put an end to all her mirth, her festivals, her new moons, her Sabbaths and her appointed festivals. I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my pay, which my lovers, inverted commas, have given me. I will make them a forest, and the wild animals shall devour them. I'll punish her for her festival days of the Baals, when she offered the smoke of her sacrifices to them, and decked herself with her ring and jewelry, and went after her lovers, and forgot me, says Yahweh. Therefore, there's a kind of... Now, what's happening? Is Hosea experiencing his marriage to this, whoever she was, Gomer? They've had three children. It looks as though it'll emerge fairly soon, though it's not clear from the text exactly. It looks as though he married her against the best advice, and the advice proved right. She actually went back to her prostitution or whatever she was involved in and left him. That's what it appears to have happened. But he, in his experience, he loved her. He continued to love her in spite of her personal infidelity to him. And that gave him an insight into God's continuing to love us in spite of our infidelity. That seems to be the... It's a lovely insight, it's an awakening insight, but Hosea's the first to have got it, and he does it fairly richly. Here's an example. So is he dreaming of going and getting Gomer back? It appears so. He does get her back, it appears so. But try and read between the lines, and let's listen to this. God saying, as understood by Hosea, therefore, because she's gone back after her lovers, she's gone back to the life that she knew, I will now allure her. I will bring her into the wilderness, and I'll speak to her heart. The wealth that they experienced under Jeroboam II, which we saw a lot about last week in Amos, that's now fallen away. They're now reduced to poverty. They're reduced to need. They're in the desert again. And the experience of being in the desert again, without the wealth and all that stuff that was going, has God then can now get to their heart, as he did once back in the desert on the way from Egypt to the promised land. I will give her her vineyards. I will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There, and this is Hosea's understanding of those 40 years of wandering, there are different opinions all through the Bible on it. The Bible isn't a consistent book. It doesn't need to be. It's getting half insights into something that's beyond insight, namely God, and they're all got value, and don't expect them to fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, because they don't. There, back in the wilderness, she will respond as in the days of her youth, at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. Hosea sees that early period as a period of first love, a honeymoon, as it were, between Yahweh and his people. When they were getting to know God and God was getting to know them, and they were poor and they were journeying and they were relying on God, etc., etc., etc. We know there's another side to that. All you've got to do is read the book of Exodus and Numbers and hear about the grumbling and all of the rest of it. But he's looking at it positively. On that day, Yahweh says, you will call me my husband and no longer my Baal. Baal means Lord, and Baal means can be used for husband. But instead of calling after the Baals, they're going to look at God as their Lord. I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be mentioned by name no more. I will make you for you a covenant on that day with the wild animals. We're going back to Genesis. And I think this is actually behind that text in Mark that you might know, when Jesus goes into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. And remember Mark saying, and the wild animals were with him. Now the wild animals were with him. What's that about? Except saying, no, this is the beginning of a reconciliation of the whole universe. This is Jesus is the one who's going to bring peace. The lion will lie down with the lamb and all of that. It's romantic, it's poetic, it's true, but not at the level of factual information, but rather at the level of dramatic feeling and awareness. So, I'll make for you a covenant on that day with the wild animals, the birds of the air and the creeping things of the ground. I will abolish the bow, the sword and war from the land. I will make you lie down in safety. Here it is. And I will take you, for my wife forever. I will take you for my wife in justice and in just judgment, in covenant love and mercy. I will take you for my wife in faithfulness, and you shall know Yahweh. Scholars again suggest we haven't the evidence to be certain, but that's probably James, take you, Mary, for my wife, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, till death do us part. No, it's their marriage formula. It's their commitment, possibly, in their culture, in their religious ceremony. God is the husband now, and he is going to, through the poverty, the suffering that they're going through at this time of their history, he's going to be able to make a covenant of love with them. And there it is, I'll give it to you again. I will take you as my wife forever. I will take you for my wife in justice, in just judgment, in covenant love, and in mercy. I will take you for my wife in faithfulness, and you shall know, and I hope you know by now in the Bible, know always means not know about, but know the intimacy through communion. It's the knowledge that comes through communion. It's a lovely text. And what's beautiful about it is it's an insight the prophet has into God, which fits with the other insights too. He sees what we do matters, and God is punishing what we do when it's wrong and all that. And in there, I think there's a bit of a skewed theology. But through all that, I think from his own experience of the fact that he still loved that woman, even though she'd gone back, he must have reflected on his love, and we all understand that, his continued love for her, and thought as he lay awake at night, gee, that's the way God loves me. That's the way God loves us. God is the faithful one. If only we would open ourselves and go back to him, he would be there for us. On that day, I will answer, says Yahweh. I'll answer the heavens, and I'll answer the earth, and the earth shall answer the grain and the wine and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. The cry of the land will be heard, in other words. And I will sow him for myself in the land, and I'll have pity on Lo Ruhamah. The one means don't have pity. And I'll say to Lo Ami, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. Now a little bit more of his personal experience. Yahweh said to me again, and this is the bit that they tell me that the Hebrew in Hosea is one of the worst preserved. Like, there's a lot of very difficult passages in it because of the way. Well, it's a pretty ancient document, and some of it has been a bit cut around and a bit lost. So it's often a bit difficult to get absolutely clear about what it means. The general. So here we've got, Yahweh said to me, go, love a woman who has a lover and is an adulteress. Is that woman the same woman, Gomer, or not? Can't be sure. Probably it is. That's what I'm guessing, or hunching. But he's now told to go and marry this woman who has a lover and is an adulteress. Just as Yahweh loves the people of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. Well, some of you might like raisin cakes, so I thought I'd better explain it a bit to you. Here's Jeremiah, we haven't come to yet, talking later, chapter 7, verse 18. The women need dough to make cakes, in fact raisin cakes, for the Queen of Heaven. And that's not Our Lady, I have to tell you. The Queen of Heaven is Astarte, the consort of Baal, the god. These are the gods of the god and goddess of the fields. You know, there's the big god, El, the high god of Semites, and this is another god and his wife who look after the harvests and all that kind of thing. And so they were making... So, and this is going on at Jeremiah's time. This is 150 years later in Judah. So customs like this are pretty slow to be purified out. So here he's saying they turn to other gods and they love raisin cakes. They love getting up and offering these to their idols and their little domestic little figurines and so on. So my comment is, Hosea refers to Israel's infidelity, clearly. Did he experience infidelity with Gomer? Was that what was behind it? I can't be sure, but probably. Was it his longing to have Gomer back that inspired him to picture Yahweh as a husband and Israel as an unfaithful wife? Probably. He speaks of Yahweh's hurt and anger, but he also speaks of Yahweh's fidelity, unconditional and passionate love for his people. And this is the first, well, we're only at the beginning of the time, this is the earliest insight into God as a one who loves with passion and fidelity, even in spite of our sin. And so, and with this I'll conclude the first half, so I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer. A homer is the weight that a donkey can carry, of barley and a measure of wine. So he had to go to the bloke that she was with and buy her back. And I said to her, you must remain as mine for many days. No more playing the whore. You shall not have intercourse with a man, nor I with you. So whatever. For the Israelites, again we're looking at it metaphorically, the Israelites shall remain many days without a king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, P-I-L-L-A-R. This is another goddess, Asherah, who's not to be confused with Astarte. So Asherah, they used to have these like a pillar, wood, a tree sometimes, but that was the symbol of her in their groves, you know, in their... Okay. So, and without an ephod, the priest used to have a... They're not exactly sure of this either, but the priest had a kind of a pinny, what I wear on Wednesday when I'm cooking, with two pockets in it, and in it was the Urim and the Thummim. Have you read about those a bit? They were dice, really. And if they wanted to know God's will, they just chucked the dice. And because they didn't, you know, like two up, really. And then if it went one way, God wanted you to go to war, and if it went the other way, God didn't want you to go for war. And they all believed it, and they were happily doing it. And never dawned on them when they lost the war that God... Anyhow, so that was their way of discerning. Pretty primitive, God's will. And you can't have any more teraphim. They're little, these little... They find them all over Israel still. So they never stopped being there. Little statues. And I suppose if you weren't a Catholic Christian, as I am, and you came into my home when I was a child and you were a Christian of some other denomination, and you saw little statues of St. Joseph and little statues of Mary, you know, and little statues of... We didn't have the infant of Prague, but we could have, you know, all these different ones. You could have thought that we were worshipping... In fact, some people do think we do. We don't, but they think we do. My argument with them, by the way, is... I said, do you have a... If your mother, their mother might have died. I said, have you got a picture of your mother on your sideboard? They said, yes. I said, well, do you worship her? Oh, no, I don't worship her. Why have you got a picture there? Oh, I like to remember. I said, well, there's your answer. Go and think about it. Like, it's just, it might, things that your eye might catch, and I remember as a little child myself. That we didn't have any of those kind of things that I can remember, but we did have, just when you go from our dining room, it was a little house, two bedroom with eight kids. So Mum and Dad were in one, my two sisters were in the other, and guess where the six boys were? Anyhow, verandas and whatever, and head up there, foot down here, etc. Well, that was all going on, because that's all we had. But when we went from the dining room into the hall, which would lead to the front door, there was a little picture there about that big, and it was kind of purple, and it was Jesus weeping over the city of Jerusalem. You may have seen it. But see, I'm only a little child, but I remember standing there looking at it for a long time. Like, it affects you. What's wrong with having things that your eyes see? And my other memory is my father praying before the big picture of the Sacred Heart, which I think is awful art. But art's one thing. This is, you know, and just seeing my father there praying in front of this. So as a little child, he wouldn't have known I saw him or anything. It affects you, doesn't it? So I think we've got to be careful about being too dismissive, too cold, too intellectual about our faith. In any case, they're not going to have any of those things now, because in their case they were, well, whatever. Afterwards, the Israelites shall return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king, and they shall come in awe to Yahweh and to his goodness in the latter days. So we're halfway through. I'm not sure what you've got out of that, but just it's a bit confusing. It's both ways, but underneath it all is the heart of a very passionate man who's been very hurt in love and in a complex love situation, and he's within the limits of his own culture and his own understanding of God's control and punishment and anger and some of those thoughts that don't fit too well with the New Testament. In the middle of that world, he still was able to feel his way into the immense compassion of God and God's readiness to forgive and longing to have us back, no matter what we've done.
He was a bit of a target for punishment, wasn't he?